Today's going to, we have one of our parties on speakerphone. And it is case number 012998, the EEOC versus the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin. Are you there?
I am here.
Good. Okay.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Gregory. My name is John Sweeney, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. I've advised the court that I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
What you like.
Thank you. I would basically like to touch on the issue of sovereign immunity and then, if possible, to spend most of the time directing my arguments to the decisions of the district court judge, the post-trial decisions which the district court judge denied. I think before we begin, it is very important to recognize and to realize and to keep in mind that the age discrimination statute is not a tenure statute. It's not a bumping statute, and unfortunately, it does not confer additional rights upon those who are in the protected category. And in this particular case, the mere fact that some younger employees are retained during a reduction in force at the university while older employees are discharged is not enough in and of itself to create an inference of age discrimination. There are several other facts which I will refer to during the course of my argument that we believe are undisputed in the record. Initially, I would like to address the issue of sovereign immunity, which the board raised for the first time here before this court. The EEOC apparently concedes that when it brings an action, it stands in the shoes of the individuals whom it represents.
But Mr. Sweeney, let's be realistic. The Supreme Court has just spoken to this point in EEOC versus Waffle House, and it has made the indisputable point that the EEOC is a federal agency, that it is entitled to bring lawsuits either because particular people have complained or because it wishes to point out that there's a pattern of practice. And, you know, I looked at their website, and even in the ADEA subcategory, in fiscal year 2000, there were some 16,000 charges filed, and the EEOC brought suit in 24 cases. They pick the cases, sometimes because it's an individual, sometimes because it's something else, but they are
pattern
the federal government. Sure, it could be pattern practice, but the point is they're the federal government.
That's correct.
The Supreme Court has made it absolutely clear in its 11th Amendment line of cases that the 11th Amendment did not reserve any sovereign immunity of the states vis-a-vis the federal government. When they signed up to the Constitution, they signed up to a particular structure of government. So I just think, I mean, we could have debated this before Waffle House came out, but it seems to me it would be irresponsible of this court to acknowledge your argument in the face of Waffle House only a few weeks ago.
There is the Waffle House decision and this court's decision in In re Bemis, which...
But we're not the Supreme Court.
Well, I understand that. But I believe there was one and only one issue in the Waffle House case, and it was dealing with the federal arbitration statute. And I quote, "The only issue before the Supreme Court is whether the fact that Baker has signed a mandatory arbitration agreement which limits the remedies available to the EEOC."
And that is certainly the specific context, but the court also said in Waffle House, and I quote, "Whenever the EEOC chooses from among the many charges filed each year to bring an enforcement action in a particular case, the agency may be seeking to vindicate a public interest, not simply provide make-whole relief for the employee, even when it pursues entirely victim-specific relief." So, again, for a lower court to decide that the Supreme Court didn't really mean that when it was speaking, even though every case comes up in a particular context, arbitration there, age discrimination here, I think would be close to an unlawful act.
There's one reported case, Your Honor, which we've cited in our brief, which we believe speaks to the issue involving sovereign immunity, and that's the U.S. versus the Mississippi Department of Public Safety. And that was, of course, an ADA case, but at the same time, that court stated that when the EEOC sues to protect the public interest, then it, in a sense, is on its own. When it stands in the shoes of the aggrieved parties, in the charging parties, then it, too, is limited.
That's the exact rationale that the Supreme Court rejected in Waffle House.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, respectfully, that Waffle House is limited to the issue in which it was dealing with, the Federal Arbitration Act. And In re Bemis was concerned with Rule 23 procedures. These cases, as you suggested, are quite recent. We would suggest to this court that it may be aided by simultaneous briefs of the parties following this argument.
Well, we've already had a Rule 23F statement of supplemental authority.
I would like to now, if I may, Your Honors, address the district court's denial of the defendant's post-trial motions. We have in both of our briefs briefly addressed the issue of a prima facie case of age discrimination, and we recognize that at this
stage... That's irrelevant at this stage.
Well, this court has recently said that in some cases it helps for an understanding as to what the elements of the issues are.
But no, what we've said over and over again is that once it's gone to the jury, the question we need to decide is whether there's evidence in the record from which a reasonable jury could have concluded that the discrimination in question occurred. Juries can believe some witnesses. They don't have to believe
Correct.
All. They can draw inferences from circumstantial evidence. And actually, even though your brief acknowledges this rule, I found most of it back as though this had been a summary judgment appeal. And it seems to me focusing on the evidence is what we need to do with this
point. And I agree, Your Honor. And if the court... I believe the court can look at the two departments in which layoffs occurred. One was in the acquisitions department, and the other was the marketing department. In the acquisitions department, there were four candidates, if you will, for layoff. It's undisputed in the record that four individuals were laid off, five positions were eliminated. And the record is also undisputed that those five positions have not been, to this day, filled at any time.
But if students and limited term employees were hired to do the very same work that the four charging parties performed, why then may they not be treated as similarly situated?
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, to suggest that the LTEs, the students, the part-time employees, took over all of the tasks that had previously been performed by the charging parties. The evidence is eminently clear that LTEs are part-time students paid $8 to $9 an hour, and frankly, they're simply not competent to perform the tasks that remain of the charging parties, who we recognize were good employees. Unfortunately, in a layoff situation, sometimes good employees are also laid off.
But of course, you certainly acknowledge that the labels that you put on various jobs don't control here. It's the substance. So whether they were students or LTEs or full-time doesn't really matter as long as the functions are being performed.
Well, I think that the titles in this case, Your Honor, suggest that the LTEs were not performing the work.
But why? I mean, you lay off these people, and as the EEOC pointed out in its brief, if you take... putting to one side this lady who was about to retire, if you take the top oldest people and you lay them off, then a jury could infer that you were getting rid of the older people.
Well, this court has spoken in Radu, which was also a case from the district court, the Western District of Wisconsin, that the fact that five out of the six oldest people were laid off or terminated does not in and of itself create the inference of discrimination, and we suggest that...
But this is not an in and of itself case, of course. We have, as Judge Rovner was pointing out, the hiring of the younger people. We have the absolute correlation between those who were laid off and age. You want us to look at these department-by-department things. The EEOC presented evidence suggesting that this was a more flexible office. The jury was entitled to believe what it
when was. When we talk about the four oldest people were laid off, that, if you will, is a creation, an argument of the EEOC when they attempted to blend classified employees, academic staff, and supervisory people. I would point out, as we have to the court, that the two decision makers in this case were 56 and 50 years old.
I really don't understand why you put so much credence in that. There are many people who think everyone else their age is very old and they're very young.
Well, there was some language like that by Judge Posner in the Price versus Marshall Erdman. But if you will recall, Your Honor, specific questions were directed particularly to Mr. Salemson, saying, do you have problems working with older people? Do you have problems working with younger people? And there was no evidence presented that they did, in fact, have problems working either with older people or that they like to surround themselves with younger people.
Oh, forgive me. I do.
I'm sorry.
But you take all the hints of age bias in Mr. Bethea's remarks about jumping the legal hurdles and the path of assembling a more agile workforce, et cetera, et cetera. It's very understandable why a jury would have found the way they did.
This court has spoken repeatedly that phrases that are sometimes used to refer to a group of people do not in and of themselves constitute or provide an inference of age discrimination.
No, you put everything that we have here together.
If you take each of the instances, each of the allegations of the EEOC in and of itself, it does not create an inference. To say that if you put them all together, that even though each of them does not create an inference, we can't infer anything from the individual facts. If we put them all together...
That's not right, because suppose every day somebody said something patronizing to a woman, patted her on the head, the next day they call her honey, you know, the next day, you know, they in some other way infantize her. Each one by themselves is probably not enough to show that this person has a demeaning attitude toward women. If it happens day in and day out, a picture emerges, and the same thing
and a pattern
in this. And when the jury looked at the whole picture, the after-the-fact justifications and the belittling remarks and the ages of the people who were terminated and the hiring of new people for the office, it's not a one item of evidence case. It's a case that does show an overall picture.
There were no disparaging remarks in this particular case, and I would agree with the court, particularly when we're dealing with protected classifications such as race and sex, that demeaning remarks such as that do send a message. However, in this particular case, what do we have? Reference to a 23-year-old?
We have the justification.
Which says, we have evaluated all of these positions. We have evaluated all of these people. And in our mind, in the mind of Professor Bethea and Mr. Salemson, they measured the skills and qualifications. They spoke to the supervisors without telling them that a layoff is coming.
From resumes that were 10 years old, 7 years old.
Right.
What was the purpose of looking at a resume when you talk to the supervisor who observes this person?
Well, that's what I'm asking you. What was the purpose in looking at those resumes? That's what they included in the justification.
They did, but they also included the fact that they had spoken with the supervisors.
But very little. They did not have. In fact, they stressed that they didn't really rely very much on the supervisors, and they made assumptions on no factual basis, you know, that somebody in their 20s would be good at HTML programming and
somebody
in his 40s doesn't know anything about
Rebecca
it.
Rebecca Jimenez.
Looking into it.
Rebecca Jimenez,
well,
based on their experience.
But they didn't know what her experience was.
Yes, they did. They talked to her supervisor. And if you remember in Mr. Salemson's testimony, he said, I, better than others, know the general overall performance of all of the employees because I, rather than the others, work with all of these people. The only evidence regarding qualifications that we have challenging the decisions, challenging the so-called unfair decision process, and this court has spoken on that also, comes from the charging parties themselves.
But Mr. Evanson, for instance, you have no evidence to show what his skill level was, what he could do in terms of HTML programming. The EEOC suggested that he actually had, in fact, these skills.
I asked that question was asked
was there.
To Mr. Evanson. You have a particular skill. You set up something on the computer. Did you tell Mr. Bethea about that? His response was, no, I did not.
And when was he given the opportunity to do that?
Well, none of the employees, older, younger, middle age, were given that opportunity. What the plaintiff is challenging is saying it's unfair. This process is unfair. And this court has spoken on such a challenge before, and saying that it may be unfair, it may be unwise, it may be an unwise business decision. And I see that my time is up, and I wish to reserve a little bit more.
Sure.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Smith. All right, Mr. Gregory. Well, we're happy to have you any way we can get you. Mr. Gregory, do you know if the Commission has appealed the Mississippi Department of Public Safety case to the Fifth Circuit?
Well, that is not a Commission case because it's brought under the ADA against a state or local governmental body.
Uh-huh.
So the Justice Department is actually working that suit. They did seek reconsideration of the decision, and I suspect will pursue an appeal, but I don't know that for sure. The problem with that case, the rationale of that case, as I understand it, is that there have to be some cases where the government can go forward and sue a state and recover damages, but only if it's a pattern of practice case, a case that we deem as a court to be sufficiently in the public interest to justify setting aside the 11th Amendment. And the problem there is, with all due respect, I don't think that you want to be in the position of telling a government agency whether a case is sufficiently in the public interest to be allowed to go forward. And I don't think that the Supreme Court's 11th Amendment case law lends any support to that. If you look at the end of Justice Kennedy's opinion in Alden v. Maine, he is chiding, I think, his listener, Seth Waxman, for saying that this was such an important issue that you've got to say that it doesn't navigate the sovereign community. And he said, if it were so important, why did you guys ever go up to Maine and brought a public enforcement action? And what he's saying there at the end, when you read it, is that if you make that decision, if the national government commits itself to that and wants to bring a suit in its own name, we will respect that. That takes it out of the 11th Amendment box. But, and he's sort of chiding the government there for not having done that. So I think it's pretty clear in the 11th Amendment case law before Waffle House that a decision by the government to pursue a claim under authority given to it combined statute places the case beyond the 11th Amendment. The only caveat to that, you can see in a case like Kansas versus Colorado that we cite in our brief, is that it can't be a mere nominal party if you can't articulate any interest of your own.
That's an unpublished opinion.
Turn the reins over to the individual, maybe in that circumstance, but we don't do that. We were in control of this case. We filed the complaint. We sought to leave that did further a public interest, like liquidated damages, like the training remedy.
Before the EEOC brings a suit like this one, does it make some type of the formal assessment or finding that the litigation will serve interests beyond those of the individuals on whose behalf it's filing suit?
Well, I think I have to say that implicit in every suit we bring, I can't say that we make a formal finding to that effect, but implicit in every suit we bring, we bring a lawsuit, we have to make an assessment that for some reason is in the public interest and worth the commitment of public resources. I certainly think this case, which involves a major state university, which involves a situation where it appeared to us that there was a wholesale lack of training and knowledge about the prohibitions of the ADEA up and down the decision-making hierarchy, that this was a perfectly legitimate call for us to say that this merited our resources. We bring, as was pointed out, one of the questions we bring, a relatively small percentage of cases that this total case is brought in court under these statutes, and it's a function of the charges that we see. So we do discuss our case carefully. And the bottom line is, from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, both pre-Waffle House and post-Waffle House, I think it's pretty clear that when that decision is made, it is respected, and that we don't want to start going down a path. This is where I think the other side wants to lead you, where you start putting here and saying, well, in this case, it's enough in the public interest, in some other case, it's not. I think the other point that's important is that the 11th Amendment doesn't really care about the relief that you're seeking. I mean, if you're immune as a state, you're absolutely immune. You can't be a little bit immune under the 11th Amendment any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. So if it has to be clear in the Seminole Tribe case that even a claim to broad injunctive relief against the state with respect to injunctive relief is your again at bar. So the 11th Amendment doesn't really care about the nature of the relief. I mean, the other side trying to issue this sort of decide which kind of relief is the public interest. But the 11th Amendment is asked, is this a case brought by the government, by the United States? Are they not considered nominal party? Are they there? Are they in control? Do they have any articulable interest? And if they do, I think that's it under the 11th Amendment. And certainly I agree that Waffle House moves me down to the point.
Yeah, I agree with almost everything that's said about Waffle House, but it seems to me that the state is in a much worse position because it has sovereign immunity than it would be if it didn't. In a case like this, without sovereign immunity, I really have a hard time imagining that the EEOC really would have taken this case. And instead of defending against the charges brought by the federal government, the state would have been in court fighting four private claimants with one or four lawyers representing them. And here they're sitting in court with the power and majesty of the federal government to bear upon the state. So they're in a lot worse shape because they have sovereign immunity.
Well, I would say this, Your Honor, and I think this is part of the subtext of the Waffle House decision, in fact, the court actually said it, which is that we bring a very small percentage of total cases in abroad. I think we'll be the court of Waffle House noted that in one of the fiscal years there were 23,000 employment type lawsuits in court in this country, and we had brought maybe 300 to 400 of those. So I think that there is protection in two ways. First of all, we do bring a relatively small percentage of cases. And secondly, it does require that the court set involvement and exercise some sort of responsibility for each we do go through a process. There has to be approval of litigation that takes time and it takes very seriously. And so in that sense, I think the state is far better off having sovereign immunity. And I think they would agree with that. I understand the point that if we do decide to bring a suit, perhaps there's someone worse position, but there still is protection there. And I guess the bottom line is the 11th Amendment, as the Supreme Court has indicated, is to protect against private lawsuits. And when we bring a public enforcement action, we bring it because we believe it is in the public interest, and we control the suit. And when push comes to shove, we make the call that we think is in the public interest. And that's how we litigate this case and would litigate any case like it.
Mr. Gregory, I don't mean to take you off the 11th Amendment if you want to stay there, but I'm also concerned that time is passing, and I wanted you to comment on the fact that this seems to be a case where there's extremely little direct evidence of discriminatory intent. The state says, gee, you know, we were in a terrible financial bind at the press, and people had to go, and it was decided it was going to be these people. And even though you may have bits and pieces of things that might have looked a little bit bad, it just doesn't add up to anything.
Well, I think the answer to that is that, you know, the gift price is definitely not a direct evidence case, but there is evidence suggested based by coupled with some awfully compelling pretext evidence. If I can start with some pretext evidence first, yes, this Mr. Fay's salesman claimed that the terminations were, you know, a necessary cost cutting reduction in force. But look at the evidence we have. We have handwritten notes and other documents from March of 1999 when they were already formulating this proposed reduction in force, in which they were already proposing to hire new people into acquisitions and marketing, suggesting it was their intent all along not to risk people, but to get rid of our charge of parties and put these people in those positions. And Mr. Mathias admitted as much trial. We got some amazing testimony in the trial that the jury heard. He said flat out that it was his intention to replace the charging party with people who would fit the quote unquote new vision of the press. And he said the only problem is they had to jump the legal hurdles imposed by ADA. And that was his testimony. Mr. Samuelson acknowledged at trial that hiring the younger individuals before the terminations that he did hire were retained, and hiring the younger individuals after firing was part of this new vision as well of the press. So, and we've got some strong pretext evidence, and in addition, we have evidence that we're not denying that there was some financial problems there, but it appears that Mr. Mathias and Samuelson manufactured this to a degree. Mr. Mathias went to the press committee and said it was a crisis because a cash flow deficit of $550,000 to $800,000, and it turned out it was only $30,000 cash flow deficit as the business manager conceded in trial. He also overstated the savings that would occur in the first year with the cut, and he failed to mention to anybody that their internal budget projections showed that if they simply continued to expand their production as they were, look, that profitability would return in 2 to 3 years. This was something he neglected to mention. Instead, he said we absolutely have to retrench and cut staff. And again, I mean, this issue about there were several very, very younger people who moved into the very same department that our people left, marketing and acquisition.
The state maintains that those younger individuals were not similarly situated in the sense that they were students or limited-term employees.
Well, that's the argument. I don't think all of them, first of all, were limited-term employees. But the key point there, I think, is that the trial, and I'll quote him, the whole press is not that large, so we can't worked, you know, pretty much with everybody, you know, over the course of a week in some respects. Others testified that there was a lot of movement between the departments and the press. So in this particular case, you know, the fact you may label these people something else doesn't detract from the simple reality, which was that four oldest employees of the present academic staff in the four departments subject to the cuts were let go. Several younger people who had been moved into the press by the sales and the key decision makers here were retained, and then in a month immediately following the termination, a number of very, very younger people were moved into the very same department. And there's no suggestion here in this very small little collegial unit that they were not absorbing at least some of the same responsibilities. And again, I think this is one of these cases where you play a game with the jury and connect the dots. I don't think it's very hard for the jury to say, okay, big next time. You've got that evidence. And then you have Mr. Mathea with some amazing testimony in trial. He's basically saying that when he admitted that it was his desire to replace these people with people who would fit the new vision. And he talked about, you know, jumping the legal hurdles that would be imposed by something like the ADEA. And he just tried 500 of these cases and not get a decision maker to say something like that in a trial like this. And the justification document is an entirely post hoc document put together after the fact to justify a decision that's already made. It is based largely on out-of-state resume. And it's got factual inaccuracy, and there is an 8-5 defeat implicit in it. You know, the sense that the author of this document did assume, without knowing, this is the essence of age discrimination, that an older person like Mr. Epstein wasn't schooled in new ways of doing things, while a younger person like Mr. Menez was. The person that Mr. Mathea, in fact, describes a highly skilled young woman that we don't want to lose. And when we asked the trial what he knew about the background, he knew very little. He was assuming certain things. So I think when you put it all together here, given the standard of review in a case like this, we have more than ample evidence to sustain the jury verdict, both on liability and willfulness. I mean, the willfulness, I think, flows to liability. We do have some additional evidence of knowledge on Mr. Mathea's part where he says, I had to jump the legal hurdles imposed by the ADEA. And I think the reckless difference part in this case, in which we have several people up and down the hierarchy here admitting that they don't know when the prohibitions of the ADEA kick in, seemingly indifferent to the fact that the ADEA is working in a case like this. As you have said in the past, in cases like Mathis versus Philip Chevrolet, Price versus Marshall Bergman, that allowing, particularly a major state university, to allow people to be in these kinds of positions and not have a little more sense of what the ADEA prohibits is the highest recklessness. And so we think we have enough evidence on both liability and willfulness. And I don't know if the court is also argued here about the trial. I think most of that is assumed within the evidentiary points. There's an argument about mitigation damage, but I think if you look through the record here, you'll see there are four people. All worked very hard to find jobs. They did find jobs. They never were given an offer of a job back at the university. When leads were given to them by the university that involved comparable jobs, they did follow those leads. I just don't think you can say here as a matter of law that they failed to make it. And the court has no other questions on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How much time for Mr. Sweeney? 3 minutes.
I will move quickly. Public safety motion for reconsideration was denied. It was in fact appealed, and it's pending at the present time.
Thank you.
Let's look at New Vision. The concept of New Vision was a very, very creative argument from the counsel from the EEOC. And as I said in my brief, it worked. But let's look at New Vision. Where does it come from? It comes from a 1995 position description when Mr. Salemson was hired. The press wanted a new vision, And so what did they do? They hired a 51-year-old man to implement a new vision. And in response to the questions, did this person fit the new vision? Obviously, the answer has to be yes. If not, why did you hire this person? Did you hire this person after the layoff because they weren't a part of what you really wanted? Of course not. There was excellent cross-examination, for example, but you had to jump the legal hurdles, right? Obviously, you have to get through any legal hurdles. And the evidence, Mr. Salemson, terminations were not a part of the new vision. No one expected them. No one wanted them. There's no doubt in the record, whether it's 300,000, 30,000, or 80,000, that the press had severe financial problems. And it would be ludicrous to assume that LTEs, many of whom were students, could perform the same works as the four charging parties. That's simply ludicrous. Certain tasks, such as Mr. Evenson's, were simply omitted. They were no longer done. The justification document is not a post-hoc document. It is a contemporary document that was done in the 3 to 5 week process with the university. Other positions were considered, not because of the ADEA, but because of university seniority regulations. The charging parties were represented, very well represented in this case by the EEOC. They were also well represented by their own private counsel in proceedings at the university and in state court, and I believe my time is up.
Yes, one more minute.
Okay. Mr. Salemson was not the key decision maker. That was Mr. Bethay. But Mr. Salemson worked very carefully with Mr. Bethay, talking with supervisors and making the business decision, which employees will help us make it in the short term and in the long term. But frankly, the UW Press could not wait 3 years to become profitable because the dean of the graduate school's first inclination was to cut out all 25 jobs. We had 18 academic staff people. 12 were over the age of 40. Odds are whoever was laid off was going to be in a protected category, which leads into the concept of willfulness. Mr. Bethay and Mr. Salemson, and the light goes on. May I finish? Thank you. Both testified that they believed every personnel decision was covered by the ADEA, whether it's 40, 50, 60. This is not a Price versus Erdman case. These people realized that this and all other personnel decisions were covered by the ADEA. That's not reckless. That's not a lack of training. That's about as comprehensive and expansive view of the ADEA as is possible. I thank you all, and your honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Mr. Sweeney. Thanks to you, Mr. Gregory, and the case will be taken under advisement.